You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
The situation remains dire for Iraqis subject to ISIL's terror throughout the country. And this includes minorities like Yazidis and Iraqi Christians. It also includes many Sunnis, Shia, and Kurds.
President Obama today, as the world dips its toes gingerly back into the geostrategic swamp of Iraq, this time via Kurdistan. I'll be joined by Jane Kinnamont and Isabel Hilton to discuss that and the day's other top stories. I'll also be speaking to our man in Copenhagen and opening a new book celebrating the best of limited edition graphic design. And...
Was passiert, wenn du ihn nicht mehr fütterst? Denkst du, dann läuft er einfach weg?
Wolski, hallo?
Ist da die Polizei?
We'll be reviewing the most horrible of the latest horror films. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. Lots coming up, as always, in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But before all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the world news.
The Finnish President Sauli Niinistö said today that he hoped a Russian humanitarian aid delivery to eastern Ukraine would pave the way for a ceasefire between the government and pro-Russian rebels there. Niinistö said an agreement had been reached between Ukraine, Russia and the International Committee of the Red Cross to let a Russian aid convoy of some 280 trucks enter eastern Ukraine. But Ukraine said its forces had attacked and partly destroyed a Russian armed column that entered Ukrainian territory overnight. Russia's government denied its forces had crossed into Ukraine and accused Kiev of trying to sabotage deliveries of aid, but European capitals have accused the Kremlin of escalating the fighting. Well, Mary Dajerski is a columnist with The Independent here in London. She said that Russia is feeling hard done by.
They look at other places in the world and they say, you know, anybody can send aid convoys and they get some credit for it. And the moment Russia decides to send an aid convoy, then it's told, oh, it's trying to send send troops or weapons in a sort of Trojan horse operation. So I think they feel deeply hard done by. But also, I think it's quite interesting that in the last 24 hours, the authorities in Kiev have mounted a little operation of their own, a little aid operation. So now there are two convoys.
Suspected Islamist Boko Haram fighters have abducted dozens of boys and men in a raid on a remote village in northeast Nigeria, loading them onto trucks and driving them off, witnesses who fled the violence said on Friday. The kidnappings come 4 months after Boko Haram, which is fighting to reinstate a medieval Islamic caliphate in religiously mixed Nigeria, abducted more than 200 schoolgirls from the village of Chibok. They're still missing. Tribal leaders and clerics from Iraq's Sunni Muslim heartland, who rebelled against outgoing Premier Nouri al-Maliki's Shiite-led government, said they're willing to join a new administration headed by the new Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi, provided he protected the rights of the minority sect, which was marginalised by Maliki. The West hopes the new administration will be more inclusive and will lead to a halt in the north of Iraq of the advance of the extremist group the Islamic State. But Saeed Jawad from the London School of Economics said that the Islamic State fighters won't be bothered by any political changes.
They are preparing their move to take more land from the government or south of the areas where they are already situated and from the north area where they are already situated. So they are attacking on both grounds and they are apparently gaining grounds on the two fronts.
In St. Louis, Missouri, police on Friday have released the name of the officer who shot an unarmed black teenager as Darren Wilson, a six-year veteran with no prior disciplinary history. The shooting, which sparked riots and a week of protests, occurred on the 9th of August, but police had withheld the officer's name until now, citing security concerns. President Obama earlier called for peace on the streets of Ferguson, where the incident took place, and urged authorities to be transparent in their investigation.
There is never an excuse for violence against police or for those who would use this tragedy as a cover for vandalism or looting. There's also no excuse for police to use excessive force against peaceful protests or to throw protesters in jail for lawfully exercising their First Amendment rights.
And finally, an Australian hospital has apologised after mistakenly sending out death notices for 200 of its very much alive patients. Austin Hospital, in Australia's second most populous city of Melbourne, erroneously killed off the patients when it faxed death notices to their family doctors. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 near enough in London. We'll be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It is 18:06 in London, but I've already told you that, and it's 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Jane Kinnunmont, Senior Research Fellow with the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Isabel Hilton, Editor of China Dialogue. Welcome both. We will start in Iraq, which, despite a long overdue change of Prime Minister, is still sufficiently precarious that the world's cartographers have been stepped up to at least DEFCON 2. In what weirdly appears all at once a plan to shore Iraq up and an attempt to further undermine it, EU foreign ministers have met today to discuss following up the lead taken by the US and France in arming Kurdistan as opposed to Iraq proper. Jane, I'll start with you. This is not a vote of confidence in Iraq's new government, is it?
Well, to be fair, Iraq's government can already buy arms internationally. They have plenty of arms from the US and so forth. I think this is an amazing turnaround for the Kurds. If you think just about 25 years ago, they suffered extreme ethnic cleansing, some would say genocide, at the hands of Saddam Hussein. Nobody cared. The world turned a blind eye. The fact that now, as a non-state group, they can get weapons from Western governments is something quite amazing. Obviously, they've now got oil, which helps, but it also reflects the lobbying, the diplomacy, the relationship building that Kurdish leaders have been doing for years, even with Turkey.
Isabel, is this, you know, implicit acknowledgement by the West that an independent Kurdistan is now a when and not an if?
That's my feeling, and it has been for some time. It's also an acknowledgement that they've been arming the wrong army. I mean, the Iraqi army, which is extremely well equipped, you know, what is the Iraqi army fighting for? What is Iraq at this point? And I think that the abandonment of its heavy equipment to you know, that is a huge risk always on a battlefield, that the enemy captures the heavy equipment of a retreating army. You know, it makes no more sense to arm the mainstream Iraq army. Kurdistan, I mean, couldn't even get an end user certificate even 2 weeks ago for importing arms shipments. So as Jane said, this is an extraordinary turnaround, with apparently the assent of Turkey, which is another extraordinary turnaround, and silence from Iran. So, you know, this isn't,
who were
of
always
course,
the two primary objectors to the
well, indeed,
of the
because
Kurdish
of their
state.
Large Kurdish population. So that if we are looking at a Kurdish state, this will again go on having ripples across the region.
It's hard to see, though. It's very easy to see that arming the Kurds helps the Kurds defend Kurdistan from the Islamic State. It doesn't actually make the Islamic State go away, though, which is surely what everybody wants. Jane, to come back to you, is also what we're looking at here, the EU and the US gently trying to ease their publics back into the idea of a war in Iraq? Because the reality is that someone's going to have to go and sort the Islamic State out, isn't it?
Or possibly just contain it. I'm not sure how ambitious they're really going to be. I think what we've seen has been an operation to prevent them advancing on a very oil-rich part of Iraq. But I'm not sure there's going to be Western appetite to go and dislodge them from the areas that they already hold. The West will be pinning their hopes on the new Iraqi government, hoping that they can get a new Iraqi national initiative together. But no one's very optimistic, I think.
But I think that they will try other methods, like buying back the tribes that have supported.
Which worked temporarily the last time, I guess.
Indeed it did. And you know, if there's less to fear from the Iraqi government than before, then perhaps that's a strategy that might at least help to contain.
It's a really unhappy choice to have to make, though, isn't it, between allowing a fairly substantial, at this point, fundamentalist statelet to emerge in the Middle East and actually going and dealing with said fundamentalist statelet.
Yes, although going and dealing with, of course, doesn't necessarily have a good outcome. And I think that the, you know, major military operations in the region in the last 10, 15 years have not had the results that they were supposed to have. So there's also a wise caution, in my view, about going back in and starting to fight Islamism on the ground. It can produce extremely negative results.
Jane, there is a difference in scale, obviously, but might the French intervention in Mali work as kind of a model? They seem to manage to put down an insurrection which had some superficial similarities to the Islamic State. It emerged apparently from nowhere, seized large quantities of desert very, very quickly, terrorised women, children, civilians, etc., but folded up pretty rapidly when faced with an air force and grown-up soldiers.
France has been relatively gung-ho about intervention in recent years, and I'm sure that's one of the models that people will be looking at and discussing. But the fact remains that it's pretty recently that Western troops, albeit not French troops, have been in Iraq and haven't seen themselves as being successful. As Isabel says, the most successful period that they had in struggling against jihadis was when it was the Sunni tribal Sahwa Awakening groups that were fighting Al-Qaeda. And there is a serious risk that having Western boots on the ground could inflame Islamists further. They're quite dug into residential areas. Civilian casualties would be numerous and would create a big backlash.
Just staying with you, Jane, before we move on to other things, how nervous do you think the leaderships of the United States and the EU are in potentially having to go back to their people and say, yeah, about that Iraq thing, we may not be done with it yet?
Well, it's incredible that Obama, having come to power saying that the US was withdrawing from Iraq, has become what is now the fourth consecutive US president to bomb the country. It's interesting
you'd
also...
You'd think they would get it right eventually,
well,
wouldn't you?
Just keep doing it. It's the thing
to do. Know where to find it.
It's right next to Iran. But it was interesting also yesterday, the Telegraph revealed that British Special Forces have been operating in Iraq for at least 6 weeks. That's something that wasn't in the public eye, probably partly because it wasn't very popular. I think the Brits are trying to do as much as they can sort of below the radar without requiring parliamentary votes, which, based on the Syria vote last year, they might well not win.
Final thought on this one from you, Isabel. This is President Obama's worst nightmare, isn't it? He can't have possibly imagined in 2008 that by 2014, Iraq would still be a thing.
I suppose it is his worst nightmare, though he is so remarkably detached from the world that it's very hard to know what gives him nightmares. And I find this whole episode, the last 2 weeks, so extraordinarily muddled that, first of all, you have this mysterious Kurdish retreat and the advance of ISIS, which there is a kind of dark conspiracy theory which says this was in order to facilitate the arming of the Kurds. Then you have the counting of the refugees on the mountain, which goes from 20,000-30,000 down to mysteriously 3,000 well-supplied people overnight. I find it very, very strange.
These things are never an exact science, though, reporting a moving story.
Well, that's true, but the numbers, the variation in numbers is quite dramatic.
Well, let's look now at the other Middle Eastern conflict, which has dominated news for the last few weeks. A five-day ceasefire in Gaza agreed 48 hours ago seems to be more or less holding. That is time in which Palestinians have tentatively begun cleaning up Gaza's more heavily battered neighbourhoods, and in which the wider political fallout has begun drifting to earth. Among the more noteworthy components of this is the empanelling of a commission into possible war crimes by the UN's Human Rights Council. This has predictably been welcomed by Hamas and equally predictably dismissed by Israel as a kangaroo court. Isabel, I'll start with you. The UNHRC, it's a bit of a joke, isn't it? I mean, it has 47 members, but those 47 members do currently include such sunlit uplands of democracy and human rights as China, Congo, Cuba, Ethiopia, Kuwait, Russia, Saudi Arabia and Venezuela.
I hope you're not implying that those upstanding citizens are not worthy members of the human rights body. Yeah, this incarnation, I have to say, of the Human Rights Commission has not covered itself in glory. Nevertheless, I think the idea that Israeli actions in Gaza would come under this kind of scrutiny is a positive thing. But I have been slightly depressed by the strength of the Israeli insistence that it was proportionate, it was moderate, it was absolutely justified. And I think that in itself sets up a whole series of negative reactions. To have a UN body look at Israeli actions in terms of international law, I think, is a good thing. Why not? Will it change the situation on the ground? No. It'll take a long time to produce any conclusions. But nevertheless, it is the kind of evidence that eventually, you know, can be used in a discussion about Israeli state policy in towards Palestine. And that isn't a bad thing.
Jane, supposing they do decide that Israel has some sort of case to answer, and we should note that they're supposed to be looking at both sides, so theoretically Hamas may well be on the hook for attempting to launch missiles at civilians as well. Mm. But supposing they decide that Israel particularly has a case to answer, what then?
Well, at first sight, it seems rather like déjà vu. Of course, we had a similar war in Gaza in 2009.
Indeed.
And we had the UN-mandated Goldstone report.
Indeed, we did.
It didn't stop us having this conflict, and indeed another one in between a couple of years ago. So you do wonder, is this just going to keep happening? One interesting change since the Goldstone report is that Palestine has been recognised by the UN as a non-member state. And there are suggestions that that could mean that if war crimes were found to have happened, they could then be taken to the ICC. Last time the case wasn't raised to the ICC on the basis that Palestine wasn't a state. And that is something that, while most Israelis will probably reject it as being quite biased, will nonetheless put some pressure on Israeli officials, notably in terms of restricting their ability to travel abroad.
You're quite right in what you were saying earlier, Isabel, about Israel's insistence that they have done everything they possibly could to limit civilian casualties. It does seem mildly absurd in the context of somewhere as built up and crowded as Gaza. But does Israel have a case claiming bias? They have claimed throughout this conflict, and again, they're going to claim it about these proceedings, if that's the right word, that they are subject to a scrutiny that no other country is or would be in similar circumstances.
Well, that is a familiar claim. I personally think the bias has been the other way. And, you know, this policy of crying while killing, you know, describing every civilian death as a tragedy in which somehow the Israeli state had no agency, I think is wearing a little thin. I think that, you know, we have seen this, as Jane says, over and over again. And I think that Israel has got away with it. But I do think it is time for another examination.
We should also note that the IDF is conducting its own inquiry, as it did after Pillar of Lead the last go-round. They investigated 82 incidents, resulting in precisely zero punishment for anybody at all. Jane, final thought on this. Is this likely to go anywhere at all, do you think?
The long-term outlook is, frankly, baffling. It's not clear what Israel's long-term strategy is. And I go back to the same question. Can this keep repeating itself? It seems that the only people in Israel who have a strategic vision of sorts are the extreme right wing, the type of people who have been saying, actually, we need to annex Gaza and send its citizens overseas if they don't swear an oath of loyalty to Israel. The peace camp is in total disarray. There are no real efforts towards any kind of two-state solution. So what is the long-term goal of the government? Very unclear.
We will take a short break on that inevitably depressing note where Gaza is concerned. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, as well as Jane Kinnan-Mont and Isabel Hilton. When we return, we'll be looking at datelines including Ferguson, Missouri, Beijing and Pyongyang. Do stay tuned.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hippi, for the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House and Isabel Hilton from China Dialogue. We move now to Ferguson, Missouri. We've learned that the United States may be reluctant to intervene forcefully in Iraq, but they have been less shy about it in a suburb of St. Louis, which has been gripped by nearly a week of violent protest following the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager, 18-year-old Michael Brown. While there are no reports of deaths or serious injuries sustained in the protests, local police have adopted a singularly menacing appearance, deploying with vehicles and weaponry looking more suited to seizing a Normandy beachhead than dealing with a public protest. Jane, I'll ask you first. The police in Ferguson are now trying what they call a different approach, which is a pleasing euphemism. Why the what seemed the bizarre overreaction?
Well, it seems to be part of a longer-term trend. In recent years, there was a law passed some years ago which allowed the military to pass excess equipment onto local police forces, and the police have taken this up quite enthusiastically and have been getting things like armoured personnel carriers and, you know, vehicles that can defend themselves against mines, sometimes in quite small towns in America. It's something really quite stunning.
I mean, I'm as susceptible to this kind of stuff as I suspect any male. If someone offers me an armoured personnel carrier on the cheap, there's a big part of me that's going to want to go, fantastic, I'll have some of that. But as you say, you end up with this situation where a suburban police force of 53 officers looking after 22,000 people can turn up with up-armoured, mine-proof armoured vehicles and camouflage uniforms. I mean, it's...
And hoping not to be noticed, maybe.
Yeah, jungle camouflage in suburban St. Louis. It's insane, isn't it, Isabel?
Yes, it's completely insane. And it's not, you know, given that these episodes are really about community relations. They're about, you know, the situation of young black men and their relationship with security forces. Mm. And everything that they do in this respect is going to make it worse. And they are going to end up, you know, hated by all sides.
Do you think it's possible, though, that if the first police response is a bunch of armoured vehicles, that is going to rather encourage excitable young folk to throw a few bricks rather than a bunch of sort of reasonably affable-looking beat police?
Well, it may well, but what are armoured vehicles going to do against several thousand women, for instance? Are they going to, you know, they're going to mow them down? You know, there is no way that these things can be deployed in a helpful fashion as policing. You know, as aids to policing, that will not make the situation worse.
And it does help to explain why so many Americans think that they should have quite large guns of their own at home, defending themselves from the state.
On that note of consensus that the whole spectacle has been utterly inexplicable, we will move on to a tale of actual police states. China has generally acted swiftly to capture and return escapees from North Korea, despite the assuredly horrific fate that awaits them. Interestingly, though, and perhaps encouragingly, China has not so far thus condemned a group of 10 North Korean runaways captured near China's border with Laos. Isabel, for a start, I mean, that phrase in itself, that they have escaped North Korea and been apprehended somewhere near Laos, that is a journey of epic proportions.
Absolutely
right there, isn't it?
Absolutely staggering. I mean, they've crossed all of China and got down to, you know, the southeast corner from southwest corner from the northeast, and clearly did it with assistance, as people often have, with the assistance of groups from South Korea who do organise kind of freedom trains for people trying to escape North Korea. China has, you know, defied international law. It has a policy of, as you say, a policy of refoulement of refugees, describing them as economic migrants. And this is what's interesting about this, is that in the context of very cool relations between North Korea and China at present, Kim Jong-un, respected and beloved leader, I think this one is, has been in power for about 2 years and has not gone to Beijing. This is highly unusual. He also executed his uncle, you may remember, and his uncle was the man who was the liaison between North Korea and Beijing. So he was Beijing's friend and was rather unceremonially topped just a few months back. So the situation is pretty cool. And this may be China's, I mean, this is one case, we'll see, but this may be China's way of saying to North Korea, you know, there are things we can do. Clearly, China's problem with North Korea is that it doesn't have many good options. But if you remember, one of the things that triggered the collapse of communism in Europe was Julia Horn, the then Hungarian foreign minister, opening the borders. So when your neighbours are no longer willing to keep your population or to cooperate in keeping your population in jail, as it were, then you have a problem. Mm.
Jane, is this possibly not just China sending a message to Pyongyang, but also maybe to the rest of the world, trying to look like they might be sort of reasonable and more reasonable and humane than generally anticipated?
I think that's probably a bonus. They were criticised by a UN report in February for this policy, but they're criticised for a lot of human rights abuses. It doesn't necessarily make much difference to policy on Tibet or Xinjiang. But if they do want to send a message to Pyongyang, then yes, doing it in a way that looks good internationally is certainly a low-cost way of doing it.
And Isabel, do we have any idea what happens to these people who have travelled in a long way at extraordinary risk?
Well, some of them get sent back. Some of them can live undercover, particularly in the border region. There are a lot of Koreans who are Chinese nationals, but ethnically Korean in that border region and who help. And then those who can get to a third country, who can make a journey such as this or up to Mongolia and reach a South Korean embassy, then they get asylum. I mean, South Korea is pretty proactive in helping people who get to third countries get to South Korea, and there's a rehabilitation program for them where they're taught about credit cards and traffic and all kinds of things that you don't see in North Korea. And they make a considerable effort to integrate them as citizens of the South.
I mean, Jane, just finally on this, what needs to happen, do you think, for China to get entirely sick of North Korea? At what point does North Korea become more of a problem than an asset for Beijing?
I think for any nuclear-armed superpower, there's not very much interest in other smaller states getting their own nuclear weapons. I think China prefers the relationship with North Korea to be one where it's very, very strongly asymmetric. It's very clear where the power lies. And if you have a nuclear-armed state, then it could be one that was capable of throwing its weight around a bit more. So there is that underlying tension. And if the new leader of North Korea continues to deprioritise and maybe mishandle relations with China, then it could actually get out of his control.
But China's red line, of course, is that it doesn't want South Korea as a neighbour, so that if the North were to collapse, you know, and South Korea would have to, you know, pick up the pieces, then China would have, just across the Yalu River, essentially a US client state. It doesn't want that. So the choices are not huge.
We will stay finally and briefly in China for one final item. We should alert our Chinese listeners that TV could prove pretty grim viewing this October. It might be time to stock up on box sets. China's propaganda ministry has issued a directive insisting that all programs broadcast that month must be rigorously anti-fascist and or nationalist. Isabel, what delights await viewers in October? What does anti-fascist and nationalist programming look like?
That's lots of heroic movies about the anti-Japanese war. Anti-fascist is code for Japan, the great struggle against Japan in the Second World War. Embarrassingly enough, for the Chinese Communist Party, not one primarily fought by them, but fought by the nationalists. But, you know, we can gloss over that. it does remind me of the latter days of the Cultural Revolution. generation when television was so dire that actually when a North Korean film came on, there was giddy excitement in our dormitory. But hopefully it won't be that bad. And as you say, China is the world capital of box sets and pirated Hollywood movies. So I think they'll struggle through.
Jane, do you have any particular fondness for those sort of Cultural Revolution era ballets?
I can't say I do, nor do I particularly enjoy the disproportionate amount of World War II coverage that we have on British television, as we like to have this nostalgia for a war where we were on the right side.
We will have to leave it there. Jane Kinnan-Mont of Chatham House, Isabel Hilton of China Dialogue, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. There's plenty coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be speaking to our man in Copenhagen. We will meet Stuart Tully, author of a book on some of the best limited edition packaging and graphics. And we'll find out how best to scare yourself at the cinema. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. The Finnish president said an agreement had been reached between Ukraine, Russia and the International Committee of the Red Cross to let a Russian aid convoy of some 280 trucks enter eastern Ukraine. Suspected Islamist Boko Haram fighters have abducted dozens of boys and men in a raid on a remote village in northeast Nigeria, loading them onto trucks and driving them off. The kidnappings come 4 months after Boko Haram abducted more than 200 schoolgirls from the village of Chibok, and they're still missing. Tribal leaders and clerics from Iraq's Sunni Muslim heartland, who rebelled against outgoing Premier Nouri al-Maliki's Shiite-led government, say they are willing to join a new administration headed by the new Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi. And in St. Louis in Missouri, police today have released the name of the officer who shot an unarmed black teenager as Darren Wilson, a six-year veteran with no prior disciplinary history. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan, and welcome back to Midori House. It's 21:31 now in Moscow, which is 18:31 here in London, and it will be very close to 14:32 in Rio by the time I finish this link. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Copenhagen to speak to our correspondent, Michael Booth. Michael, welcome to the show.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Very well. We're starting with a slightly grim story tonight, and a slightly surprising one, given that I think Denmark exists in the popular imagination as this sort of very sort of well-ordered and well-run place where almost nothing bad ever happens. The listeria outbreak.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of true. Almost nothing bad ever happens here. But unfortunately, in a world where we're familiar with the threat of Ebola from Central Africa and Salmonella in the UK and chickens, Denmark has its own nasty bacteria problem, and actually it's unfortunately leading the world in listeria outbreaks, and since September 12 people have died in Denmark from a listeria outbreak, which has finally this week only been traced to a pork processing company just outside Copenhagen, which makes salami and all sorts of hot dogs, things like that. And 20 people actually contracted the disease since September, and 12 have died, mostly elderly and vulnerable. But unfortunately, these kind of cheap pork products, processed pork products, do tend to find their way to kind of council-run elderly care homes and those kind of places. And I mean, that's one thing, but there's a kind of broader story to be told here about the pork industry, the world-famous pork industry in Denmark, which is not all it's cracked up to be, unfortunately. The health standards and hygiene standards and animal care standards are just not up to scratch. And this is just one example of that problem. Another is some incidences of MRSA in Danish pork. And two journalists, Danish journalists, were recently put on trial for exposing MRSA in the Danish pork industry. So there's not just the health risk. There's the sense that the establishment is somehow kind of trying to put a lid on it and cover it up.
And what has the official response to this been? Presumably the government must have reacted to what is obviously a fairly major story. It would be a major story for anywhere, but especially Denmark. Are they going to insist that things are done differently?
In terms of government, virtually no reaction whatsoever. This has gone through the processes from the serum, State Serum Institute and the Danish Veterinary and Food Administration. It hasn't really gone to, hasn't become a political issue at all, which is quite surprising. It would have done in other countries, but not in Denmark. It's been left to the various regulatory bodies and health institutes to take care of it. And you do wonder, I mean, it is the holiday season for the Danish politicians, but you do wonder, when is someone going to step in and take control of this and kind of take some authority over this problem? The other thing to point out, unfortunately, the agricultural industry in Denmark, and in particular the pork industry, has a very strong lobby group, and they're very powerful in the Danish parliament. And that all kind of combines to make one a little bit uncertain about Danish pork products, particularly the industrial pork products at the moment.
Well, moving along, we are, of course, here at Monocle 24 and in Monocle magazine, big fans of rail travel. We're especially big fans of intercity rail travel. There's talk of a new link between Copenhagen and Oslo. Is this likely to happen?
Likely, maybe not. Possible, yes. You know, Monocle loves a big infrastructure project, especially when it involves public transport, and this is a mooted high-speed train link. Think of that, from Copenhagen to Oslo in 2.5 hours. That would be quite cool, really, wouldn't it? I mean, the idea is to link together 8 million people, not just in Oslo, the Norwegian capital, and Copenhagen, but also Gothenburg and Malmo, the third and second biggest Swedish cities, en route. And this is all part of a process that's happening in Scandinavia and the Nordic countries generally, to kind of come club together to combine their might and attract foreign investment and foreign knowledge skills to the region. They feel a bit like they're punching under their weight, and if they get together a bit more, then they stand more of a chance to compete globally, and that's all part of that project. I mean, another element of that is they are actually, this is actually happening rather than a speculative thing, they are actually building a bridge now to Germany from southern Denmark, so that train and road traffic won't have to go all the way up through the Danish peninsula of Jutland, but can go directly to the bottom of Zealand and up through the Scandinavia. That is happening. That's the Femern Bridge, and that's going to be finished supposedly in 2021.
You quite rightly note that we here at Monocle do tend to be suckers for the big infrastructure project. Is that enthusiasm for this one shared by the people of Denmark?
Well, this story's really only just gained currency in the last week, so I don't know. I mean, the Danes do love a big infrastructure project. They're great bridge builders, famously. You know, the Øresund Bridge was once, until a few years ago, the largest span bridge in the world. So, yeah, there is big enthusiasm for that, because they've been shown, A, that they can do them, they can carry out these massive infrastructure projects, and B, they can make them work and make them pay money. So, yeah, I would imagine there would be great enthusiasm. You know, in a way, Denmark and the Danes might be quite tickled to be connected to their old colony of Oslo, which used to be called Christiansberg or something like that. So I think there'd be a sense of reconnecting with their historic past.
Well, on the subject of public transport, we should move on to Copenhagen Airport, because we're also very keen on air travel here as well. And apparently so are a lot of other people. It's had its busiest month ever.
Yeah, I mean, everyone loves Copenhagen Airport. It is one of the best airports in the world, beautiful and efficient, and they don't lose your luggage, right? So, and 2.6 million passengers came through in this July, which is the busiest month in the entire history of Copenhagen Airport. It's 7% up on this time last year. That's really a reflection of the fact that Copenhagen has been incredibly successful in promoting itself as the central hub of Scandinavia, maybe even, dare I say it, Northern Europe. And I would say that it is because, you know, we know we're not going to lose our luggage when we go through Copenhagen, as we do in Heathrow, Charles de Gaulle and Milan.
Well, I can say from personal experience that I've been through Copenhagen Airport 4 times that I can think of, and they haven't lost my bags once. So that's that is a useful illustration.
Bringing endorsement.
But are those numbers, is that, and that's a huge bump, that 7% year on year. Is that reflective of a perceptible increase in people not just transiting via Denmark, but coming to Denmark as well?
Unfortunately not. Tourism numbers are down. Cruise ship numbers are up. And numbers from the BRIC countries, from Russia and China, are up. But Denmark has been an extremely expensive proposition for tourists in the last few years.
I remember that as well.
One other thing to say about this air transport is Denmark is, Copenhagen is aiming to be carbon neutral by 2025. And I'm wondering, well, how does this huge air hub fit into that whole thing? And I think, unfortunately, the truth is they're just not going to include it in the figures.
Michael Booth, thank you very much. That was Michael Booth, our man in Copenhagen, and his book on the Nordic Dream, The Almost Nearly Perfect People, is available now. Up next, we'll be looking at a book celebrating some of the best limited edition packaging in the world. Stay tuned. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
If you're looking for a present for a loved one, something for the home, or some luggage to take on the road, why not visit one of our shops? Our beautifully appointed shops in London, New York, Toronto, Hong Kong, and Tokyo sell a selection of the fruits of our collaborations with a number of our favourite brands, including Porter, Hackett, Ettinger, Barena, and many others too. Plus, we can also help out filling in any gaps in your collection of back issues. So why not visit any of our shops today? You're guaranteed a very warm welcome.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1840 here in London. Now, the idea that we cannot and should not judge a book by its cover is arguably the most muddle-headed of all conventional wisdoms. We do it all the time, which is why so much thought goes into those covers, not only of books, but of magazines and albums. Some of the most spectacular and innovative packaging is now lavished on special collector's items intended to retain value for the physical artifact in a digital age. And some examples of that are collected in a new book, Collector's Edition. And joining me now is Stuart Tolley, the book's author. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why do this? What was the idea behind putting this book together?
It came from about sort of 6 years ago, where I was really inspired by the Radiohead in Rainbows box set. And I saw the kind of the model that they had of pay what you want. And also they released a deluxe edition as well. And I was really fascinated by the fact that people would pay £1 for the release of the album, but then also spend £40 on the box set. And I was really fascinated that people would spend a lot more money on the artwork. And that triggered something of, I think, a bit of a trend within the design industry and the publishing industry. And I looked at that for a period of time and followed the trend, and then basically thought they would make a fascinating book, and then decided to approach publishers. And I'm working with Thames and Hudson now, and
Because this has always been, I mean, I know from having a background as a music journalist, this is a lament in portions of music fandom, that the move from 12-inch vinyl down to CDs completely sort of ruined, or at least severely circumscribed, the idea of cover art. And then, of course, the move from CDs to nothing circumscribed it even further. Did you find that people were putting these limited editions together as an entirely commercial imperative, trying to put together something people would buy, or was it out of a real love for artwork celebrating the art as well?
I think it's purely out of love. At least the items that I've featured in the book are definitely like that. I think there are sort of cynical edges of reissues, but I'm really, really fascinated in the idea of creating a piece of artwork for its own value in its own right, and they stand up upon themselves. I mean, the items featured in the book are very, very collectible, they're very beautiful, and also, you know, they use the large format, which you don't have on CDs, you don't have on downloads, and certainly don't have on streaming.
What were some of the more ornate or out there or just flat-out expensive examples you encountered?
There's a lot. There's some very, very expensive books featured. There's a 25 grand book by Chris Ofili. There's, lots of very unique one-off things. There's an album by Beacon, and it's made out of sugar cubes, and there's only 20 of them in the world, and I absolutely love that. But I think my favourite out of all of them is the Flaming Lips Gummy Skull one, which is a crazy, crazy idea, which during a period of their time in their sort of album period, they were released by their record label, and they had complete creative freedom. So they released this EP made out of gummy bears, which is the size of a human skull. And then inside, you eat, basically the idea is you have a party, you get everybody together, you eat the gummy skull, and then you get to the strawberry jelly brain in the middle, and then you eat the strawberry jelly brain, and then you've got the USB stick in the middle, and that kind of brings everybody together. It's just completely ridiculous, outlandish idea. And it's also digital as well, you know, so it's not a physical, it's a physical object, but it's not a playable physical object in terms of vinyl records. So I was just really fascinated by that combination.
We did hear at Monocle magazine put a gummy bear on the cover last year, if memory serves. That particular artifact, do you know what the sticker price for the gummy bear skull was?
Well, from what I remember, they used to throw them out at gigs. So basically, they were very collectible for that reason because they were free. But you can buy them on the Flaming Lips website for something like $180. But I don't think they're available in the UK. So they're largely in America. But I've got a couple in the exhibition that's coming up next week. So... they're very rare. So I've got two displayed at the exhibition at the KK Outlet, which comes out on Monday.
The KK Outlet is here in London?
Yeah, it's at Hoxton Square, 42 okay. Hoxton Square. So yeah, the book comes out on Monday the 18th, and I'm putting up an exhibition which runs from the 19th to the 31st of August. And it'll be displaying the Gummy Skull, and it'll be displaying the Sugar Cube album that I mentioned earlier, and also be displaying a lot of other features and people like Dinos Chapman, Matthew Deer and Irma Boone books. So yeah, it's like a huge selection. It's about 20-25 items. So
yeah, I mean, it's encouraging these things still exist, because again, I can remember being a music journalist back when the music business actually had any money, and they used to get sent occasionally bizarre promotional enticements and trinkets along with records that they wanted you to review, but they have now mostly disappeared. It does now just seem to be the extremely eccentric high end that's still left.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that as we enter the streaming era, people are really, really fascinated by the complete opposite to that. So I actually believe that the middle end, which is basically CDs, paperback books, let's say, are probably going to struggle a little bit. So people are going to stream, but then they're also going to collect and buy and keep. So you might hear an album that you really love, and then you'll buy the ultimate collector's edition of that. So I actually think it's quite a buoyant market, and I think it's something that of a sort of slight design renaissance right now, particularly with hardback books and limited edition vinyl, which obviously vinyl is going, kind of sales of that are going through the roof at the minute with Record Store Day and other kind of music outlets. So,
but the market for these limited edition items, is it? Is there a generational aspect to it? Is it mostly selling to people who grew up with the idea of music as a physical artifact?
Not to my knowledge, no. I think the biggest market for vinyl sales at the minute is between 18-year-olds. I think they've grown up in a digital age and they're getting bored of their parents being obsessed by Facebook or whatever. And they're just not interested. They're kind of, the rebellion is to be anti-digital. But my book, go to pains to say my book isn't anti-digital. I like the combination between the two, and I think it's very, very important the two can coexist. But I think the buoyant market is the youth market.
You spoke to a lot of the designers as well, obviously. Were they generally optimistic that there was still a place for this? Because it's very hard to find optimism anywhere in the music business or book publishing.
I think there is a lot of optimism. I think you can speak to certain people and it's all a bit doom and gloom, but I think the things that have basically frightened people aren't necessarily really cause and effect. So I remember when I've worked as an art director and designer most of my life, and there's always been a cloud of iPads and digital magazines over the top of your head. But actually, the reality is people are still interested in tangible objects. And that is very, very important. And that is what my book documents. So I think there is, an audience and a market for it. So,
do you have a particular favourite in the book or the exhibition?
There's a lot. I mean, I was recently interviewed about to list sort of my top 10 favourites. Like I say, the Gummy Skull from before is amazing. I love a book called James Jennifer Georgina, which is an incredible artifact designed by Irma Boone. And it's got this, she redesigned the idea of a spine, how a spine can be produced, which I love that. I love the one that's the Beacon one by Ghostly International, which is basically made out of sugar cubes. There's only 20 in the world. There's too many, to be honest. There's loads. I get very enthusiastic about it.
Remind us again where the exhibition is.
It's at the KK Outlet, and it's from the 19th of August to the 31st of August.
And the book is out now or nowabouts-ish?
It's out on Monday, so Monday the 18th.
And I'm sure you took special punctilious care with the design of this book as well, right?
Yeah, as a designer, it's very, very important to me to make it look as beautiful.
It is indeed a handsome-looking volume. Collector's Edition by Stuart Tolley, available now. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us. It's 1848 here in London. It's time now for a bit of music. In a few minutes, we will be looking at recent horror film releases. To get us ready, here is the probably inevitable song. The as if you need to be told. That was Michael Jackson with Thriller, and it's played basically in the hope that your recollections of the video for that will have got you in the mood for our next item, because it is coming up for the end of the show here on Midori House, which means it's time to review the best, occasionally the worst, in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, etc. Today we're talking films, specifically horror films, and joining me in the studio is Alan Jones, film critic and author specialising in horror, co-director of Film 4 Fright Fest, an international fantasy and horror film festival here in the UK, specifically at The View in Leicester Square. It starts next week. We're going to be talking about three of the films that are being shown at Fright Fest. The first of these is The Guest. It's the homecoming stranger template. Without giving away the point at which it all goes horribly wrong, what happens?
I can't say too much about this, actually. a soldier turns up at a family's house and says, "I knew your dead son."
And they say, that's never going to go well.
And they say, "Come in, you know, we'll look after you for the weekend." And of course, they learn more about his past and actually what's really going on. I love this movie. What can I tell you? And the most important thing about it is that it's Dan Stevens, who's the star, who everyone will remember for dying spectacularly well in Downton Abbey, and has now gone to Hollywood and had this amazing makeover where he's sort of turned into like Hunkorama. You just won't believe it. And it's really put him on the map for the latest Hollywood star to go to from every film people want to see.
As a horror aficionado, do you have things at this point that you know you're looking for in a horror film? Because like all genres of anything, it has its cliches and its tropes, which it has to observe, but can also play with or subvert.
That's true. But I mean, my rule of thumb on this is, and I see a lot of films at other film festivals, we choose everything like at Cannes and Berlin as well. And if it's good, we know instinctively, and I know what the audience is going to go for at this point. After 15 years of doing this with Fright Fest, and after a 35-year career, I know exactly what horror works and what doesn't. You're absolutely right. There are cliches and tropes that people have to follow. But if you subvert those, I mean, there's always supposed to be only like seven scares in the world, isn't there? Like there's supposed to be seven stories. But as a result of that, if they're done well, yeah, I mean, it's the way it's directed. It's all about that. It's all about the delivery.
Okay.
So yes, I can always tell.
And you recommend The Guest on that front?
Very much so.
Okay, we have a clip of The Guest.
My name is David. I knew your son. I was with him when he died. One of the things he asked was for me to check on y'all. You and your whole family here. I said I'd do that, and so here I am.
Would you like to come inside?
Thank you, ma'am.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Call me a skeptic. I'd have been inclined to say, not today, thank you.
Ah, but he gets her just as she's really quite teary. And, of course, there's a picture on the mantelpiece of this guy with her son. So what is there not to believe?
Yeah.
If you love films like The Terminator and John Carpenter's Halloween, which is it's almost sort of like a very similar version to that, you'll love this. And it has one of the best soundtracks you'll hear this year, really like sort of like electropop. It's absolutely fantastic, this movie. I love it.
Okay, well, let's move along to The Signal, which on the subject of tropes and conventions, etc., does end up at some point, without giving away too much, with people going into an abandoned house in a remote location. I've never understood why you would do that.
In this case, they're after a supercomputer hacker who's been sort of like dogging their systems at the
I'm
university.
I'm glad you completed that sentence.
Where they work. And so they're trying to find out what is behind all this. This goes into some really, really incredible areas that you really do have to see the movie to find out about. It is on the cusp of sort of 2001 Space Odyssey type
okay.
of stuff. It really is. It bowled me over because it was so unusual. It is more on the science fiction side than it is the horror. That's rare for us to show as a closing night film. But to be honest with you, we loved it so much. And the vision in it, and William Eubank is becoming like another major celebrated talent, the director. So, and Brenton Thwaites, who's the star of it, you might have seen in Maleficent recently. He's becoming another major sort of like A-lister too. So we've got them just at the right time for that. And I think it's it really delivers the thrills and space age goods, really.
Okay, well, that's the signal. It stars Lawrence Fishburne. It sounds a bit like this.
Can you tell me your name?
Nicholas Eastman.
Are you from Earth?
Yes, I'm from Earth.
What I'm about to tell you, Nick, you may find a bit disturbing. Due to circumstances surrounding your condition, I'm afraid that our information is extremely limited.
You mean my condition? Wait, what's my condition?
And that's from William Eubanks, the second selection by this evening's guest, Alan Jones from Fright Fest. The final one you wanted to talk about, which I inadvertently half announced there, was a pioneer, I guess, in the field of German samurai films, Der Samurai. Do we like this one?
Very much. It's very rare for a horror film to come out of Germany these days. They're very down on it and they don't make money there. But Till Kleinert, who's the director, is a really, really special talent. This is so terrific. I love calling it like the Dress to Kill of Germany. although it's called The Samurai, it's really only the sword that's actually really important in this, because it's a guy in a dress killing people in a small German town with the samurai.
What's not to like? Is this one of those things where the sword kind of has a mind of its own?
No, not at all. It might be the alter ego of the policeman who's given him the sword. It might be something else that's going on. But, I mean, all I'm going to tell you is that Till Kleinert is very well known in German for his sort of gay cinema. So it's got a lot going on in that department.
That's Der Samurai, The Signal, and what was the first one? The Guest. I've got it all written down here. Three of the films playing at Fright Fest, curated by our guest Alan Jones. That's at The View, Leicester Square, London. Next week it starts?
It does indeed. 21st.
21st next week. Alan, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks also to our earlier guests, Jane Kinnamont and Isabel Hilton. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie, research by David Pleasant and Erin Duffy, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The menu follows the headlines. That's Marcus Hippie on food and drink. Then at 2200, The Monocle Daily with Ted Kravitz and Emma Nelson. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, but for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.